it seems, to have a dream, to open and run a bakery. But they took a chance, took the sweets to the street. Now they all have places where I'd love to eat.
Hello there, bakeroos and bakerettes. Welcome to the Rise Up Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Dick, and this is the show about bakers and bakeries and bakery owners and all the folks that work so hard, often through the night, to make the good stuff and share it with the people in their community. How are you this week? I hope you're having a good one. I really am. I hope June's treating you well. If you're in North America or the north of the world and market season is well underway now, and if you're a market baker, I hope the markets have been fantastic. We've been out to a couple around town as we do. You know, one of the fellas that I've been trying to talk to for the show is Josh at Stark Raving Bread, who is over at the Moss Street Market here in Victoria. And every time we go to that market on a Saturday, he has the biggest line. He has the biggest line of the entire market. There are always, more than a dozen people in line. And his bread looks amazing, although I never get close enough to really see it because the line's too long. That's just the way it is. So I hope that you're all having the same experience that Josh is and just, you know, serving the people, making the good stuff, serving it up, all of that. Hope you're doing well. Before we start the show for real this week, I just wanted to give a shout out to the folks that replied to my email newsletter over the weekend. Now, this has been a rare thing that I'm trying to make more routine, but I actually send out an email newsletter to all kinds of folks, all kinds of interested folks. The people that receive my newsletter are a mishmash of podcast listeners, of friends of mine from various careers and jobs and projects I've been part of. And it's also folks back home in Regina, former customers of my bakery that wanted to stay in touch after I stopped baking and we moved out to the West Coast. I wanted to send them a weekly newsletter, just like I wanted to send you a weekly podcast. Doesn't always work. And while the podcast has been intermittent, the newsletter has been very intermittent. But I wrote one last week, and I'm trying to get back into the habit of writing regular newsletters with goofy stories, with recommendations of books I've read that you might like, of things I've seen that you might like, of a little bit of commentary, a lot of opinion, and sometimes even some pictures. And if you wanted to see what the heck that's all about, it's easy to find as well. RiseUpPod.com, where all of the shows are, the whole archive of all 170-some episodes of this podcast are there, along with, in the sidebar, is a little sign up to get the newsletter box. And if you plunk your email in there, you'll get the newsletter when I send those out. No more than weekly. And folks that have been on the list for a long time will laugh at that because it's also much less than weekly. But I'm trying to get better and get more consistent with that as well. Consistency seems to be a problem with me lately, and I don't know why, but I'm working on that. So to Arlo, who sent me a lovely note and some pictures, to Jeff McCarthy, who sent me a really nice email, to Lori Sands, to Nate, thanks for reaching out. It was great to hear from you, and I'm glad that that you're doing well. Even when you're having ups and downs, I'm glad that you're still fighting the good fight and making the good stuff. Oh, and while you're at the website, signing up for the newsletter and listening to all the past episodes of the podcast, there's another pretty handy-dandy little button right at the top of the website that says support this show. Because if you didn't know, this podcast is 100% listener supported. Folks like you are signing up to give a one-time tip or a regular monthly donation, buying me a cup of coffee, buying me a loaf of bread every month. And all of that, when you add it all up, it's what pays for all of the tech to make this show work and to make the podcast stay accessible and to make it sound half decent and that kind of thing. Quite literally could not do this show without the support of listeners like you. So head on over, sign up to the newsletter at riseuppod.com, click that support the show button, and know that you are playing a very important part of keeping this show going. like it has for the last 4 years. Thanks. Okay, let's get on with the show. So the idea that I want to assert on today's show and advocate for is this idea of don't farm on rented land. That saying, you know, I think casts ideas to things like, you know, sharecroppers that were pretty much wage slaves and indentured servants to the landowners in the farming communities in North America, where, you know, somebody owns the land, you farm it, and we'll provide a place to live and maybe a company store where you can spend, you know, company money, not real money. But the whole system is set up to keep you, force you to stay on the farm and to get you further and further in debt. Because how sharecropping worked was you paid half your harvest, went to the landowner, and there was a minimum. And so if you have a bad year, you owe the landlord more than you take off the fields, right? And so, you know, you can't make your rent. And so then you go into debt. And so before long, you are forced to stay there and continue to work and continue to work, trying to have enough good years that you might be able to pull out of it. But the system is set up that you can never pull out of it. And in the hard land case with your bakery, you know, it comes down to, do you own where you bake or not, right? You know, are you leasing or do you own the building? And I know that for a lot of us, leasing your space seems like it's the only option. And yet it's a struggle. It was a struggle for us at Orange Boot Bakery. You know, we leased a space. We leased an old convenience store, did the leasehold improvements. It didn't take too long to realize that, boy, things really aren't in our favor here. Like, you've got to pay, you know, whatever your lease rate is, whether you sell anything or not, whether you're open or not. Okay, that makes sense. If you need to build out anything to make it, to make your space not a convenience store, but a working bakery, it's all on you. But if you put in high quality furnishings and high quality fixtures and high quality flooring, it all goes to the landlord, unless you can stay there long enough to wear it out. So it's as worn out as what you inherited. And even if the major stuff in the building goes wrong, like in our case, we had an ancient office capacity air conditioner on the roof, which was way underpowered for what we were needing at the bakery. And also, it was old, like it was 30 years old. It was end of life. But if the landlord replaced that, we were on what was called a triple net lease, which meant we would have had to pay for it. Sooner or later, we would have had to pay for it. He might pay for it on the day that it goes in, but at the year end, when it's time to settle up for our operating costs, we would pay for it. And so you get into a lot of cases where the landlord is making decisions that cost you money, and you don't have very much influence, if any influence, into those decisions. It's not a good setup. The alternative, of course, is owning your own space. Whether it's folks that bake from home, a lot of the advantages of folks that bake from home and cottage bakers, the disadvantage is, yeah, it's smaller capacity and smaller output, and you've got new hoops to leap through with the health departments and that kind of thing that aren't used to cottage bakers. You might even have caps on how much you can produce depending on where you live, but at least you own all the space. And so the decisions you make that improve the value of your property, those are your decisions to make and your investments to make, and you're in control of it 100%. Even if you go to a traditional brick and mortar bakery, the number of folks that I've talked to that have successful long-term, you know, sometimes even multi-generational retail bakeries, they own their own space, you know, and they tell me this, oh my gosh, this is, sometimes it's the biggest asset they have is, like, you know, no matter how the bakery's doing, worst comes to worst, I can always sell the building and I'll be okay, right? Or you get into where the only way that they could, you know, build onto and rearrange things and restructure is the fact that they own their own building, and they were able to make the decisions like, that garage is now my proof box, that kind of a thing, which you just can't do in a lease space, or you can't do without a lot of negotiations and a lot of expense in a lease space. So there's advantages to that. But, you know, I'm realistic about this, right? Like, if one could actually buy a building where I live in downtown Victoria in a prime location, and even if I could find someone willing to sell me the building, you know, because the guys that own these buildings and are leasing them out, they know they've got a good thing. Why would they sell it, right? They're going to pay a lot of money to sell it because you're giving up an income stream by selling it outright. So it's going to cost millions. And so where does a baker get millions? You know, like that's a lot of bread. That's a lot of pastry. So it might not be possible to just go from baking out of your house or from the first stage that your bakery business is at and saying, now I'm going to go to like owning a building on Main Street in my town and opening up there. But if you know the disadvantages and you know the pitfalls of leasing versus owning, maybe there's things that you can do in the design of your business to make it a temporary thing or be able to adjust as things change. Things change in the market, things change with your landlord, that kind of a deal. You know, and so I sat down and kind of brainstormed a few ideas like what could you do, right? And, you know, structuring your finances so that you can absorb the inevitable rent increases might be important, right? Like the one thing that's guaranteed is that your rents are going to go up. It burnt us big time at Orange Boot Bakery when our lease was coming up for renewal and we got the word that, hey, our rent is going to go up at least 20%, probably 25%. Maybe even more, where our business was not growing at a fast enough rate to absorb that, and we didn't have it structured that we could absorb that kind of a rent increase, and it put us in a big bind. We had some real serious decisions to make in that final year that we were operating. You know, being prepared to move, right? You might not be in a food truck, but you might have to move locations if rents get out of hand or the building starts to crumble and it's not yours and you don't want to invest in improving the infrastructure that you don't own. You know, it might be about changing the relationship between the tenant and the landlord so that you both have skin in the game. I've heard stories. I have not experienced this personally, but I've heard stories about where, well, I'll pay a rent reduction, but we're going to share, you know, you get 5% of sales over a certain amount or something like that. Something that says as the business does better, the landlord can make more. But sort of the opposite of the sharecropper structure, whereas that in a bad year, the landlord still gets paid. You know, is there a way that you can share some of the risk as well? Share the risk, share the reward to make things more stable and more plannable, more predictable for you as the business owner. It's not easy with land. It's not easy with the physical location. You know, there's a story, probably you've heard about McDonald's, is that as McDonald's was expanding like crazy in the 70s and 80s, you know, Ray Kroc realized they weren't in the hamburger business, they were in the real estate business. And so they set themselves up to own the real estate and the best real estate in the most high traffic spots in all of the different cities, which is why the McDonald's are where they are right now. That's not something that we can do necessarily right off the hop as a bakery owner, but it's something that we can plan for as to say, okay, how can we get to one day, 10 years in the future, 15 years in the future, maybe it's longer in the future, that we can move from leasing the building to owning a building. From renting a location to owning a location, and turn that from that major expense from being an expense into an asset for you, instead of an asset for someone else. But if it's difficult to do this with land, it's not as difficult to do this in other aspects of the business. And the thing that I'm really thinking about the most these days is about how you do your marketing at the bakery. Because a lot of us are doing our marketing on rented land as well. And I'm talking about the big social media companies, the Facebooks, the Instagrams, TikTok, that kind of a thing. There are small businesses, including bakeries, that are putting 100% of their marketing efforts onto those platforms, onto Facebook, onto Instagram. And the owners of those platforms, the landowners, are changing the rules to make it tougher and tougher for you to succeed on those platforms. And they're doing it by design. It's a strategy. It repeats. It repeated for me. I'm going to tell my Facebook story. When we opened up Orange Boot Bakery in 2010, I, like everyone else, you know, every day I was posting on a Facebook page. Orange Boot Bakery had a Facebook page, still does, I think, because I still get notifications that people are looking at it, even though it says we're permanently closed and have been for years. But I created that page, and over 1,500 people signed up to that page. And that's what we would do every morning. When the baking came out, we would tell the people. That's what someone would say, Mark, you got to tell the people. And I'd sit down at my computer and I'd do a post for our Facebook page saying, here's what we've got going on today and here's what's happening at the bakery. And at the start, if 1,500 people followed the page, 1,500 people would get that message and it would show up in their news feeds. And then very drastically, fewer and fewer people started getting the message. Half the people, a third of the people, a quarter of the people. And what that was replaced with was emails to me saying, hey, do you want to reach your whole audience? All you have to do is pay Facebook and we'll boost your post and you can reach all the people that have actually said, I want to hear from you. It makes a great business model for Facebook. You go build your audiences, give us all that personal data that says that these people like bakeries like this, like small businesses like this, so we can sell them targeted ads. And then we're going to force you to buy those targeted ads just to reach the same people that you worked so hard to get to follow you. It's totally in the advantage of the landowner, of the platform owner. And the same thing is happening right now with Instagram. And it's the same play out of the same playbook, oddly enough, owned by Facebook, right? So it's no different. All of a sudden, you're not seeing every post by your friends or by the people that you follow in the order that they come in, unless you go and start monkeying with your settings to make that happen. The Facebook or the Instagram algorithm is deciding what it is that's coming to the top. And so now you have a choice to make. You can spend your energy trying to figure out the algorithm and get your stuff to float up to the top, or you're kind of hooped, or you're going to live with, oh, only like 20% of people are going to see my post. I think for most of us, even those of us with very large Facebook and Instagram followings, that's not a way to do it. Like, it's not set up in your advantage. You have no control of that relationship. You have no control over who's seeing your stuff. Let's not even go down what other stuff is getting inserted in and around your post that might not be the kinds of things you want your bakery associated with, might be things that you just disagree with. Because the other thing about social media is that they're trying to get you on the platform. If I'm a consumer, get me there for as long as possible. And there's two ways to keep me there as long as possible. Keep me excited and anticipating good stuff. So I'm scrolling and scrolling and scrolling, or slowly get me more and more outraged so that I'm scrolling and scrolling and scrolling. I don't know if you want your bakery being beside stuff that's outraging people just to say, well, proximity effect, at least they saw my post, right? That's not what it's about. It might be extremely difficult to own your own land when we're talking physical land, when we're talking the building. It's not as difficult and it's not as expensive to own your own platform when it comes to your marketing. And to say, look, I've got my own website. Do I have an email newsletter? Do I at least have the emails and the names of my best customers that are coming through the door at my bakery? If I needed to, could I reach them? How would I do it? We serve people in a neighborhood, right? In a certain location. We can do direct marketing to folks. We can do leaflets in mailboxes. We can do posters on telephone poles. We can do things in the local in addition to whatever we're doing online. A much better model, and one that I'm really advocating for, and I have been for years across all types of businesses, is owning your own platform when it comes to your marketing. Own your messages, own your marketing, and as much as you can, own your customer list. your own customer list. Don't leave it to Facebook and Instagram and Twitter to know who all your followers are and how to get a hold of them. Set up the systems in your business that you can keep track of that information, capture that information, keep people excited to hear from you, but do it more personally than just throwing stuff on Instagram. And I want to be clear. I'm not saying delete your Instagram account and never post up there. If that's what you're into doing and if that's what gets you going, go for it. But if you are making it your only thing, if you're not trying to say, hey, if you're really interested in what I'm doing on here on Instagram and you want to learn more, here's how you can learn more. If you want a deeper connection, here's how you can have a deeper connection. That's the missing piece in a lot of cases. And that's the thing that I'm encouraging you to do. Own your own platform when it comes to your marketing. And it can be as simple as an email list. It can be as simple as an email list that you capture at the bakery as people come in, that you can sign up for stuff. Because let's put it a different way. If I'm at a market, if I'm selling at the farmer's market and I have 200 people coming past my stall every day and I have a little capture form to say, hey, sign up for our email list and you'll get the straight goods. You'll get advanced notice. You'll get specials, that kind of stuff. You'll hear from us directly. And let's say over the course of a day, only 25 people sign up. So just over 10% of people that are coming by your stand are signing up to your email list. You already know that those are the people that are the most excited to hear from you. They desperately want to hear from you. They are anticipating hearing from you. You want to know that, right? It's a quality over quantity thing. And being able to reach your 200 top customers who voluntarily said, yes, please, I want to hear more from you. That's a beautiful position to be in. Back at Orange Boot, when we were doing like a Valentine's Day special or a Mother's Day or Father's Day special, it was the folks on our email list that heard about it first and got the advance notice. And there were times where we could only make 50 or 60 Father's Day baskets. That's all we had the capacity for. The people on our email list got advance notice of, we're doing this thing. If you want in, sign up now. Here's, you know, place your orders now or else you're going to miss it. And there was some prestige. There was some advantage to being on that email list. We quite often sold out, or at least sold 80, 85% of our special products straight from the email list. It's to your advantage to know who your best customers are and be able to reach them directly. And I just want to say that it's also in your advantage for your best customers, that your best customers, I'm going to use the L word, your best customers love you and they are glad that you're there and they want to support you. And so this, just signing up for a private email list that I'm going to send you notes once a month and just check in and see how you're doing, people respond to that. And your best customers, your most eager customers are going to leap at that opportunity. And so I'm not coming at this from a marketing perspective of like, oh, you know, social media is dead. Email is the hot trend this year. I'm talking about relationships, getting permission from your best customers to deepen the relationship with them directly and not through a middleman like Facebook and Instagram. So then when Facebook changes the game again, it doesn't affect your bottom line. Okay, so let's end it there for today, because this is probably a really good spot to ask more questions and to start having a conversation about this with you. So to summarize, don't do all your marketing on rented land. Own your own platform. Own your own home base when it comes to your marketing, where your customers know that if they come to your home base, they're getting the freshest, the most delicious, the most insightful, the most connection that they can get with you from a personal perspective with you and your bakery. And that comes down to a list of your core, key, most important customers. and as much information about them as they are willing to give you. Willing to give you. So that implies permission. So it is getting permission from your customers to share personal, anticipated, relevant information about your bakery with them directly, not through a middleman like Facebook or Instagram. It's just, I'm giving you the straight goods from me to you. If you're getting permission, that it implies that you're asking for it and you're receiving it willingly. You are inviting people into a relationship with you. Every customer who comes into your bakery gets an invitation. Everyone who comes to your farm stand gets an invitation. Everyone who visits your website gets an invitation. Everyone in your neighborhood, if you're willing to drop a little leaflet into their mailbox, gets an invitation. If you're reading marketing books, you're going to hear the word capture a lot. We're going to capture this information. I'm using the word invited. You are inviting people into a relationship with your business. That's what it's all about. We can talk a lot more about this. I'm going to save some room for questions. My questions for you this week: what are you doing to build out your own marketing platform and not just be dependent on the big social media companies? What are you worried about? What are you saying? Mark, this is not going to work. There's no way, no how. I can barely do Instagram. I'm not sure as heck not going to set up an email list. Let's talk about that. So send me what you're doing. Send me what you're afraid of. Send me what makes absolutely no sense to you. And let's keep the conversation going at the end of next week's show. Reach out to me at Mark with a K at riseuppod.com or head over to bakersforbakers.org. I'm going to put a post up there as well, and we can continue the conversation at Bakers for Bakers if that's what you'd like. Alrighty, we'll be back in a minute with your questions from last week's show. So last week's episode was about systems at the bakery, and got three really good questions that came in based on that show. And so let's get into it now. Karina brought up ordering systems as being the thing that's really getting her going, especially on busy days. She says they implemented online ordering, which is kind of working. Sounds like it's a ton of work for her, but it's kind of working. The big one is now when you've got phone-in orders on busy days and you've got folks at the lineup and you've got folks on the phone trying to reserve things, and what do you do? And there's lots of opportunities there for little hiccups and little snafus where people take two orders at the same time for the last croissant. And that's a tough one. Like it really is. I know we had our general rule was the person in the line, the person at the bakery gets the product, and folks, when they reserve, got told, yep, if I can hold it for you by the time I hang up this phone, you'll get it. But if I can't, you might not get everything you asked for by the time you come down. It's a tough one. I don't think we figured it out really well either at Orange Boot. I think the best we could do was once in a while we had to give a call back and said, you know, I took the order and I was close to the display case, but by the time I got over there, what you asked for was gone, and sorry about that and better luck next time. But yeah, priority always went to the person standing in front of you. And I have to give a credit to Jory Downer in Illinois about that, because back in the day, I had a similar issue with ordering, or more the case of, you know, the first customer of the day coming in and wanting to buy all the croissants that you made that day, because they had a big function and forgot to phone in advance and order extras. And I had a problem with that. I thought, boy, that was, I thought your bad planning doesn't mean that every single customer that comes in today is going to be upset because we don't have any croissants, because the first guy bought them all. And Jory's advice to me was, he said he told his staff that if it wasn't bolted down, it was for sale to whoever came through the door. And so he would sell a rolling rack if that's what people wanted, because he could always go buy another one. And I changed my attitude after that. I had a good laugh and said, yeah, okay, I get it. We're here to sell things. We don't always get to determine who we sell them to specifically. And if people are coming in with money and want your products, sell them your products. And so I learned that one. So that's when we instituted the rule of the person standing in front of you with money gets priority over the person on the phone. But that was as good as we got with it. We never really did figure it out perfectly. And then two beautiful points here from Angela at Ethos Bakery, also over on Bakers for Bakers. First off, she shared a quote from James Clear in Atomic Habits, which is a pretty popular book these days. She paraphrased the quote as, "We don't rise to the level of our goals, we fall to the level of our systems," which I thought was pretty darn powerful, right? Like it's the systems that you build are what is going to allow you to pay attention to achieving the goals that you've set, and kind of not so much the other way around. I thought that was interesting. I've been noodling on that all week as well. She said the tough one for her was wholesale, and how much flexibility do you give to wholesale customers to change their orders day to day or week to week, that kind of thing, because too much flexibility messes up your wholesale structures and all your wholesale processes. But, you know, no flexibility, you know, we're pleasers, right? We're trying to be nice. We're trying to be flexible. I don't have any big advice on that one. My encouragement is to head over to Bakers for Bakers and join in on that conversation. If you have something that you can share with Angela, I was thinking about this, and a friend of mine, Yvonne Chartrand in Edmonton, he told me once, he said, you know, the thing about wholesale, the reason it's wholesale is that the baker gives up some of the price, gives up some of the revenue in exchange for predictability. So if you don't get predictability as the baker, is it really wholesale? and I thought, oh, that's interesting. You know, why am I giving up the revenue if I'm not gaining predictability? And so there's something in there for you, Angela. And I'm going to dig in a little bit more with you back on Bakers for Bakers about that. And then finally got a great email from Stephen Knight out in Seattle. He also brought up a book called The Power of Habit. So habits are kind of the real thing when it comes to systems, as you're trying to document and teach other people your good habits. Maybe that's a way of thinking of systems. Or maybe not just your good habits, but here are the good habits that we follow at the bakery, and documenting that. And he shared a story about how when he first started working at Dahlia Bakery in Seattle, you know, they were mixing like a dozen different doughs every day for all these different restaurants. And there were more details for him to fulfill correctly than he could keep track of. And his system was to use a dry erase pen to always like mark off an ingredient. Every time it went into the mixer, got checked off, got checked off, got checked off. He also, and I've done that one too. The following my finger when I'm tired and sort of following my finger down the list, it started to fail for me. And so I was doing the same thing. I was using the marking pen to check off every single thing that went in. Because it's too hard to keep track of other ways. Another advantage that Stephen brought up in his story, he was sharing about how when he started implementing systems for himself, maybe it was just how he set timers or things like checking things off his ingredient list. And he got used to that system. It started to open up new opportunities at the bakery. And I think that's a really good point. So here's the straight quote from Stephen. He said, "After a few days, my system became ingrained. And through repetition, I learned, for example, that I had enough time while the baguettes were baking to slice the loaves that had to go out at the 6 a.m. delivery." That's dead on, right? It's like if you get into the system of, I can do the same thing, same time every day, and you start seeing that pattern, you start seeing other opportunities open up, because it is a pattern. And if you don't have patterns, you can't see the opportunities. If it's just a random collection of events every day, there aren't going to be any opportunities to improve. Yeah, thanks for that, Stephen. That was a really good point. And also, and Stephen being the radio guy that he is, he also gave me some really interesting ideas of how I could do live podcasts and live call-ins for these questions as well. So I'm thinking on that. That sounds like a heck of an idea. Maybe we could organize a live Q&A roundtable, and that could come out as a podcast for the folks that can't make it live. That might be fun. All right. So thanks for your questions. Again, if you have questions about this or any past episode, there's two ways to do it. You can head over to bakersforbakers.org, join the community over there and ask your question. It might not make it on the show, but it might just get answered by another baker that's a part of the community, and that's even better, isn't it? The other way, reach out to me. Email me at mark@riseuppod.com. I'd love to hear from you, and we'll dig into your question in a future episode. All right, that's it for this week. Thanks for being part of this. Thanks for experimenting along with me as we try these new things. Until next week, bake lots, work hard, make the good stuff. Happy baking. Bye-bye.